Hello and welcome to the Seattle Named London Theatre Podcast for the 11th February 2018. My name's DRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Rothschild & Sons at the Park Theatre. This is a musical with music by Jerry Bock and lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, with a book by Sherman Yellen. It's based on The Rothschilds by Frederick Morton. It's directed here by Jeffrey B. Moss. John, could you tell me more about it and what you thought?
Well, the first thing I want to say about this is it's a really good idea to make a play about the origins of the House of Mayor Rothschild. He and his family grew up confined in the Judengasse, quarter of Frankfurt, before the Napoleonic Wars. And we think about ghettos and we associate them with Nazi Germany. But this is really, you know, before the beginning of the 19th century, when Jews were separated from Christian citizens in German towns. And their bravery and cunning in raising a global financial empire is amazing. I mean, it is an incredible story. But does it have to be a musical? You know, it's really hard to write an 11 o'clock number when the ghetto closes at 9. So Rothschild & Sons has been around for a little while. It was originally entitled The Rothschilds, and it was written in about 1970 by Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, who were the joint composers of both She Loves Me in 1963, which was recently revived at the Meunier, reasonably well, and Fiddler on the Roof, 1964, which has been recently packing in the pensioners at Chichester. But my suggestion is that with those two productions of Middle European stuff, they had completely mined their seam of Central European schmaltz long before they wrote Rothschild and Sons. The next thing to ask is Marmite kosher? This is certainly a production with differing appeals. People with Jewish heritage may get much more out of it because the success of the Rothschilds against severe opposition from Europeans, politicians, princelings, warmongers, whatever, makes them a justifiable beacon. But for the rest of us, for me, Gwyn, this snippet of history has less obvious charm, particularly as staged here. So even though the setting is the late 19th century, broadly the era of Hamilton, if we're making comparisons, this music is thoroughly and only rooted in klezmer, you know, Jewish heritage music, as though there were no other ways to underscore the tenderness of Jewish romance or the steel of Jewish determinism or the strength of Jewish family bonds. A lot of time is wasted in the first half of the production showing the sons as kind of cowering apprentices in Meyer Rothschild's shop in what feels to me like a sort of watered-down version of the draper's scenes in Half a Sixpence. I wanted to know much more what happened to the boys' differing careers. You know, they went on to create banking houses in London, Paris, Vienna, and Naples. And how did they get into the wine industry? Actually, just to sidetrack for a moment, the wine industry is a fabulous story, which I think is much more worthy of a musical in its own right. The family bought its first vineyard in 1853, but Meyer's great-grandson, I think it is, Philippe de Rothschild, was evacuated during the First World War to a village near Bordeaux, where he developed an interest in the local vin not-so-ordinaire. But he was an amazing character. He was a playboy, he was a racing driver, he was a bobsled team owner, and at the 1936 Winter Olympics refused to allow his team to participate because of Germany's treatment of the Jews. So far, so very theatrical, but add to that the fact that he married a French aristocrat, then an American fashion designer who was a direct descendant of Pocahontas, but his final partner was Joan Littlewood, founder of the Theatre Royal Stratford East and committed left-wing near-communist. Joan gave up her beloved theatre, moved to France, and wrote Philippe's memoir. That, I think, is a story much more worth telling. I think I'd make a great play. So, back to Rothschild and Sons. It's well cast. The five boys do tremendous work. They harmonise beautifully. And as their founding father, hang on, no, can't call him a founding father because that's Hamilton again. As the founder of the family, Robert or Bob Cuccioli, American actor who played one of the sons in the American production and now takes the lead, is a vocally charismatic addition to London's leading men. I really hope he gets another opportunity to show off his acting and singing talents, because he's given very little to stretch him in a score as insipid as this. That's really the middle and both ends of it. So, Gareth, tell me if you liked it any better than I did.
Well, I very much agree with John. The first thing I'd say is that it isn't suitable for me for musical theatre. I do think the story is told quite well in both the book and the lyrics, but I just don't think the musical theatre form is right for this particular story. And the second thing I'd say is that I think it has more of an appeal to people of shared heritage, perhaps, than to others. And I certainly felt the night I went that, you know, the rest of the audience were getting something and perhaps empathising with something and identifying with something I wasn't. And I felt very much like that upstairs at the Gatehouse a couple of years ago when I saw Jack Rosenthal's musical of The Bar Mitzvah Boy. And I felt very much the same at that point. I felt that other people with a shared heritage actually got something else out of it that I wasn't getting out of it. I mean, I don't think you can argue that it's pretty well executed. As I said, I thought that the book and lyrics tell the story well. And I think, although the staging is kind of perhaps a bit tentative and there's nothing sort of shining about it, you know, the performances are perfectly okay. And I think it's the material and the form that is the core issue, really. These two, as we know, have done Fiddler on the Roof, which is, you know, a similar heritage story, but they'd also done She Loves Me. But they've written six other shows that we don't know so well. So I wonder whether, you know, they weren't as consistent as a musical pairing, Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick. I wonder whether they were as consistent as we thought they were on the basis of those two sort of big hit shows, really. So I'm kind of glad I went to see it as sort of part of the collection, for want of a better word. But other than that, I'm not sure I would recommend anyone other than somebody who might identify with it more to go and see it. But good for the Park Theatre for putting it on, and good for them bringing it over to give us a chance to see it, really.
We're now going to talk about The Divide by Alan Ayckbourn at the Old Vic. This is a play that Alan Ayckbourn presented in Edinburgh last year, at which point it was in two parts. And it was due to be in two parts when it came down into the Old Vic, but they managed to shrink it from 5 or 6 hours down to a much more reasonable four. So instead of having to book for 2 days, you're now only booking for one. It's directed by Annabel Bolton, with a design by Laura Hopkins and music composed by Christopher Nightingale. The cast includes Erin Doherty, Sophie Melville, Thasita Jayasundara, Jake Davis and Warusha Opeya, and they're joined by Lucy Briggs-Owen, Buffy Davis, Richard Katz, Lawrence Moody, Joanne McGuinness, Martin Quinn, Letty Thomas and Finty Williams. I suppose you could call it a YA science fiction play, if you wanted. But Gareth, what did you think of it?
I think it's more of a sort of cry for tolerance and a rage against fundamentalism, really. But it is put into this kind of future context. Even though we were at Edinburgh when it was on, and we knew that, I booked for it in London thinking I don't want to waste 6 hours of my Edinburgh time, which is the length it was in Edinburgh in the two parts, in Edinburgh if I can see it in London. So after the Edinburgh reception, I really frankly wasn't looking forward to it at all. And even though I'd heard it was come down to, well, I obviously knew it's come down to one part, but it was 4 hours. That's still, you know, the anticipation of that was still a bit of dread, to be quite honest with you. So as is sometimes the case, you turn up at the theatre thinking, I'm not sure I want to be here. And it sort of surprises you and confounds you, because I actually did enjoy it very, very much indeed. As you say, it's set in the future. We start with an author at a kind of book launch or book reading, and her book is based on her teenage diary. And this is Buffy Davis at that age and Erin Doherty in the bulk of the play. And we then flash back to the story that is effectively diarised. And it's in a society where the men and women are segregated. There's been a plague which has just killed men and many men. And the belief is that the women have been infected and are carriers, and that's why only men have died. So same-sex partnerships become the norm by necessity, I guess. And in the northern half of the divide, you have men, and in the southern half of the divide, you have women, and they partner together as mama and papa. or Ma Pa, sorry, the two sort of names. So the Ma Ma has children by artificial insemination, and if they're male, when they reach adulthood, they go to the north. They're female, obviously, they stay in the south. And this society in the south does have a governing council. They're ruled by a book, which is called the Book of Certitude. And they have parties. We don't know whether they're elected parties or whatever, but the parties have names that are sort of fairly obvious. They're called Orthodox and Moderate and Progressive. And the story revolves really around this Orthodox family, the Clay family. And there's a brother and sister, Elihu and Soween. And Soween is the teenager whose diary effectively is being used to tell us this story. But it's actually Elihu who is the person who kind of threatens the balance of this society, because he falls in love with the daughter of Progressives just before he's due to go north. And this girl, Gila, has already been identified by his sister as her future partner. So that's the sort of tale we're telling, really. One of the things I struggled with at the first was that because it is, he didn't actually write it as a play, he wrote it as prose. And because it's in flashback as a diary or memoir, there's a lot of direct talking to the audience. And often when that happens, there isn't enough interaction between characters. But I kind of got used to that, really, and accepted that's what it was. I thought the staging was actually very good. And, you know, the previous week I'd seen plays that were 3 hours and 20 and 3 hours and 30, and this was 3 hours and 50. But it actually didn't feel as long as the other two. So in all fairness, it was well-paced, and it didn't feel its length. And I thought the production by Annabel Bolton had a lot of invention in it. You know, she uses projections and curtains, and there was a kind of a lovely flow to it, a lovely kind of organic flow to it as well. It's all in a kind of black and white, grey, single colour palette, which again I found a bit dull at the beginning, but, you know, come to sort of accept that. Maybe the story sort of won me over and I didn't really care about that. But the music you mentioned, Christopher Nightingale's music, really, really does add a lot to the piece for me, particularly to the sort of the intuitive feel of it, particularly because it's played by a small ensemble, but sung by a 26-piece community choir. And we've seen that a couple of times in recent years, haven't we, at the Young Vic. So I really enjoyed it. If for no other reason, Erin Doherty, who is Soween, this is a huge role. I mean, she's got so many lines. And, I mean, she's impressed me three times already in the last year. She was in the last production at the Old Vic in Christmas Carol, and she was excellent. And she was in Wishlist at the Royal Court upstairs. She was in Jack Thorne's Junkyard musical, which toured and came to Kingston. So, I've already kind of earmarked her as someone to watch. And wow, you know, in this, she's just completely sensational. And I think what differentiates her from lots of other actresses is that she invests an incredible amount of emotion into her performance, which really kind of grasps you. So I thought she was just marvellous. Jake Davis has also been quite impressive a few times in Barbarians, at the place that became a theatre on Charing Cross Road that used to be a set of offices. I can't remember the name of it now. But he was impressive in Barbarians there, and he was impressive in something at the Royal Court, I think it was Yen. I thought he was excellent at Delihu, and Wiruchopia, who plays this girl Gila, I think also was terrific. So those three central roles were really, really well cast. And then around them, a great ensemble. And, you know, given it's only got 10 days in London, I mean, these are big roles they've had to learn, you know, for a 10-day run, really. I think it's got a touch of Margaret Atwood about it. I mean, you do sort of think Handmaiden's Tale a bit, and it's not very Aitbourne, you know. I mean, we're used to Aitbourne doing clever but middle-class social comedies, and this certainly isn't that. But then again, you know, he wrote it as prose rather than a play, so perhaps we shouldn't be surprised by that, really. So, you know, I wasn't looking forward to it, but wow, I came away really glad I went to see it. And I think the most important thing of all is that, you know, there is a message in the play, and the message is about tolerance, and the message is about fundamentalism in any form, really. I mean, this is a fundamentalist society built on those particular premises, but it could be any other. So I would recommend it, except it's obviously too late to go and see it. And I doubt whether we'll have another run, but there we are. What did you think, Tim?
I certainly agree that it didn't feel the full 4 hours, which I was rather dreading, I have to say. And I do know at least one other theatre blogger who decided not to go because it was 4 hours long and just couldn't face it. But I enjoyed it quite a lot. I mean, I'm not a big fan of this way of doing things. You know, you have this post-apocalyptic idea and it's seen through the eyes of children. It's not really my thing in terms of the way I like to see stories like that told. But, I mean, obviously, you can't complain about the way he's told it. But, yeah, you know, it's got some great performances, of especially Aaron Doherty and Jake Davis and Rory Shapira. And also, you know, sort of some people have become favourites, like Fasita Jayasundara and Sophie Melville, who are always good fun. Lucy Briggs Owen, I thought, was also very good in it. I didn't entirely feel that the background of the epidemic of the plague had really been thought out, and the way that the divide was done, because it does look as if they're dividing. I mean, it was Salisbury, wasn't it? Because they're talking about Sarum Council. So the divide we see is that they're basically cutting Salisbury in half to emphasise the divide, and the divide is not sort of a divide between the north and the south so much as the north and south of particular places. So each town or city is divided in half, and the men work in a sort of a more industrial urban place and the women work more in a rural area. So I wasn't entirely happy with some aspects of the setup. And another thing is that they keep talking about we're sort of almost, what is it, 150 years after the divide? I couldn't quite work out. We were over a century after the divide, but when they reset time, and initially we're always talking about before and after the divide in terms of time, and then they switch it back to Anno Domini, Common Era, and we're now in sort of 2107. So it's almost as if the Great Plague was AIDS. And that's the plague he's talking about, and he's sort of having a split going on and the divide happening much earlier. At least that's what I thought it was happening. Maybe I got it slightly wrong. But as I say, it was an enjoyable play, a little bit long, and I didn't quite get on with the science fiction side of things, but it was very well told, I thought. And, you know, this is the thing about Alan Ayckbourn. He's, you know, he really knows how to write a play. He knows how to inject character and sensible sounding lines, so this is something he can always do in his sleep, and it's always interesting to find out what he's decided to write about. And sometimes he goes off on a bit of a ledge. I mean, there are one or two times he tries to be experimental rather than just being sort of this middle class like comedy that most people associate him with. He does sometimes try to step out of line, and sometimes he gets it right. And I think more or less he got it right here, although it is still very, very long. And I have a feeling it wouldn't have worked quite as well as two separate plays.
When you've seen it, you think, how on earth did you make this 6 hours? It's hard to... Maybe they spend more time in the north, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, and also it's possible... I did think one or two characters were a little slightly undercooked, you know. Certainly the relationship between Saween's Ma-Pa and Ma-Ma. I thought Fintey Williams didn't have enough to do, really. We're now going to talk about Long Day's Journey Into Night by Eugene O'Neill. This is on at the Wyndham's Theatre, having first played at the Bristol Old Vic as part of their 250th anniversary celebrations. It's directed by Richard Eyre, with costume and set design by Rob Howell, and it stars Jeremy Irons as James Tyrone, Leslie Manville as Mary Tyrone, Matthew Beard as Edmund Tyrone, Rory Keenan as James Tyrone Jr., and Jessica Regan as Kathleen, the maid. It concerns a fading matinee idol who has bought a play. This reflects Eugene O'Neill's history. His father bought, I think, something like The Count of Monte Cristo, and then toured it as practically the only person in the country, in America, who could play it. And he's toured it for 30 years. And James Tyrone has taken on this play. It makes an awful lot of money every year, which he seems to invest slightly badly, and we're never sure if he is a skinflint with an enormous pile of money or is genuinely bad at business and keeps losing all the money he makes on his play, this play that he hates, and takes him away from being a great actor and the promising matinee idol that Mary fell in love with. Mary Tyrone is a somewhat... you're not sure if she's a tragic figure or a bad person, because the reason for this is that she is addicted to morphine, having been given it, much like Eugene O'Neill's mother. Again, this is a very autobiographical play. Having been given it after the birth of her son Edmund, she was in so much pain they gave her morphine and she became addicted to it, and goes into periods where she tries to give it up and then falls back into it. And what we learn here is that having had a period where she has been off the morphine, on this particular day as it opens, we slowly discover that she is back on the stuff and people are rather unhappy about it. The two sons, Edmund, the younger son, is suffering from tuberculosis. It's something that his mother doesn't want to face, but the other people are facing it. And of course, there is going to be a question of whether or not James Tyrone's skinflint ways are going to affect him if he goes to a sanatorium looking for a cure for TB. And then we get James Tyrone Jr., who's the son who has kind of failed at everything and has drifted off into alcoholism. I can't remember if he's the Eugene O'Neill person, or it's Edmund Tyrone who is Eugene O'Neill, or even it's the unborn child. Certainly James Tyrone Jr. turns up in a later play of Eugene O'Neill, which was done at the Old Vic a decade ago, a play called Moon for the Misbegotten, where James Tyrone comes back after pretty much everybody in his family has died, and he comes back to a piece of land that his father has invested in. This production has a really good pairing of Jeremy Irons and Leslie Manville in it. I've seen it several times before with people like Jessica Lange and Laurie Metcalf. And actually, this production, I found that Leslie Manville's playing of Mary Tyrone was much more interesting. It might just be that this is about the third time I've seen this play, and normally it takes me three times to really get all the words in a play in my head, and therefore, you know, the third time is usually the charm for me when you watch a play, especially a big long play like this. So you capture all the words, you've got all the words in your head, and you're just there to watch the performance. And I was very impressed by Leslie Manville in a way that I wasn't quite so impressed by the Americans who've played this part, because she was much more controlling. And you know, you've got that sense of how in a house where somebody is addicted, that they can be much more in control of how people behave, and you know, very, very much more controlling and bossy, which I don't quite think I've seen before. They've all been a bit ethereal. This is a very much tougher woman, a much stronger woman that we're seeing in Leslie Manville's performance. Jeremy Irons is, as ever, excellent and extremely believable as this once handsome young man. I mean, we have seen him for years and years and years being that almost that matinee idol in the early 80s and becoming this gruff old actor. So I think, you know, overall, this is an extremely impressive production. You do feel the length a little bit. I certainly felt the length a little bit, certainly in the last act. That does feel like a very long journey. You really are waiting for the gang to get together so Mary Tyrone can make her final appearance. And it works overall, but there are a few bits of longueurs in the production. But, you know, I can't complain because the performances are so good. I mean, it's fascinating that when I think about when I first saw Leslie Manville, which must have been 30 years ago, she was a very well-respected actress, and people are slowly waking up to who she is, which is a really great thing. But, you know, it's taken quite some time. What did you think about it, Gareth?
I enjoyed it, but it didn't engage me emotionally as much as the play normally does, and I'm not sure why. It also didn't maintain my attention either, same as you, and I'm not also sure why. So, it's possible this is me, not the production or the play. It's possible that, you know, it wasn't the right thing for me that night. It is the play that started my, I suppose, obsession with Eugene O'Neill. I mean, the three great American playwrights of the 20th century are the three great playwrights of the 20th century for me, Eugene O'Neill, Tennessee Williams, and Arthur Miller. When I first saw this 30 or so years ago, this started my Eugene O'Neill phase, which has gone on to this day. And I will name drop the production that I first saw it in, because I think it's particularly timely. And it was a Jonathan Miller production. It kind of seems to have invented the concept of overlapping dialogue, which is what actually shortened the play a bit. James Tyrone Jr. was actually played by Kevin Spacey, and his mentor, or the person who became his mentor, Jack Lemmon, actually played James Tyrone. So that was a pretty extraordinary place to start with the play. And since then, I've seen people like Timothy West and David Suchet do James Sr., and I've seen people like Jessica Lange as Mary Tyrone. And in the production she was in, an interesting bit of trivia: the Irish maid, who's played very well here by Jessica Reagan, is actually played by Olivia Colman. So very much looking forward to seeing Jeremy Irons and Leslie Manville. I do think their performances, particularly Leslie Manville's, but also Rory Keenan, who's the sort of spiky James Jr., and Matthew Beard, who plays the more fragile Edmund. I think all of the five performances are really very good indeed. I loved the look of it. I think Rob Howell's kind of created this wonderful environment. It's a kind of quite an impressionistic design. It's actually quite beautiful to look at, to be honest. And in a way, the design and Jessica Regan's kind of more lighter character as Kathleen kind of lighten the play, really. Because it is, you know, it's a very depressing piece, a very dysfunctional family. You know, you've got this man who's charismatic, but he's a bit of a bully. And then you've got, you know, this nice lady who's an addict. And you've got a son who seems to drink a lot and follow his dad, but for all the wrong reasons. And then you've got this very seriously ill other son. So, you know, it is quite a depressing play in a way, but it is Eugene O'Neill's most autobiographical play. And as you said, I mean, it's, you know, each of the characters can be linked, I think, to people in his own life. He did actually insist, I mean, it wasn't performed in his lifetime. He insisted that it wasn't published until 25 years after his death. And then, even then, published but never staged. That was his instructions. But his widow didn't honour that wish. And it was actually both published and performed a matter of years after Eugene O'Neill died. So I think it's a very good revival. You know, my particular connection with it, I think, may be just a bit of a fluke. But it's certainly great to see work of this quality on the West End stage. Great to see, you know, people of the quality of Jeremy Irons and Leslie Manville on the stage. Leslie Manville currently Oscar nominated, of course, for Phantom Thread. And good to see the Bristol Old Vic's 250th anniversary being celebrated with two West End transfers, with The Grinning Man and with this. So, very welcome revival in the West End, I think.
We're now going to talk about Lady Windermere's Fan at the Affordable Theatre. This is part of Dominic Drumgoole's classic spring Oscar Wilde season. And this is the second of them. It stars Samantha Spiro as Mrs. Erlin, with Kevin Bishop as Lord Darlington, Jennifer Saunders as Duchess of Berwick. We have Joshua James as Lord Windermere, and Grace Maloney as Lady Windermere, and Joseph Marcel as Lord Lawton. We also have Victoria Blunt, Matthew Darcy, Roger Evans, Natasha McGee, Amy Metcalf, Charlie Mulliner, Sian Pohill Thomas, David O'Reilly, Benedict Salter, and Gary Shelford in the mix. This production is directed by Kathy Burke with a design by Paul Wills. I was rather disappointed in The Woman of No Importance, and I think this is a massive improvement on it. I think Kathy Burke had a very nice light touch with the play. I liked Jennifer Saunders, and I thought she could make a very good Lady Bracknell, another Oscar Wilde matriarch. But I thought Kevin Bishop, when I saw him, was still being Kevin Bishop and not being Lord Darlington. But especially I liked Samantha Spiro and Grace Maloney as Mrs. Erlin and Lady Windermere, because they brought across the dramatic side of things, whereas people like Jennifer Saunders are there for the comic relief, and also for Joseph Marcel as a rather funny lord in love with Lady Erlin. You know, if they can do it as well as this, then there is hope for the rest of this season, and hope building up to final one, which will presumably be The Importance of Being Earnest. So, Gareth, what did you think about this?
I'm probably a bit less positive about it than you. I'd sort of see the first two plays the other way around, really. I thought I preferred the other one to this one. Not in terms of production, because I think this production is very, very good, but in terms of how well the play has lasted. I feel this play isn't as worthy of revival as a Woman of No Importance. And it was when I was kind of reading up about the plays that I was quite struck by the fact he was not really that prolific as a playwright, because he only wrote 9 plays, and only 4 of them are now sort of ever staged, really. This is kind of social satires. And I was also puzzled that Classic Spring have decided to do in this sequence, because what they've done effectively is they've taken the 2 less regularly staged ones and done them first, and now we're moving into the 2 more often staged. And I would have thought to build an audience with the 2 most often staged and then moved into the rarer ones, or to alternate them one for one, might have been a better strategy, because I worry a little that they might have lost a bit of an audience or not built enough of an audience with these first 2 plays. It must have been very shocking at the time, you know, the subject matter. I felt now it just kind of feels a bit awkward and a bit old-fashioned, really. And even though it's actually quite a feminist play, and you've still got his trademark kind of bon mots or whatever they're called. And there are lots of fine things about the production, but it didn't, for me, breathe new life into what still felt like a bit of a museum piece. I thought the costumes and the sets were superb. I thought Paul Wills had done a cracking job, you know, bright, colourful and frankly gorgeous. And I loved the sort of the frontispiece, which had explains the fan positions and what they mean, which I really liked. I thought Grace Maloney, you know, this is a West End debut, and it's a big role. You know, it's the role, it's the title role. I thought she was very impressive indeed as Lady Windermere. It's a very young role, you know, it's a newly married young lady who's just had a baby. So, I mean, she's cast the right age, as it were. Samantha Sparrow, I thought, is very well suited to the role. You know, this Lady Erlynne is very assertive, very defiant, and I think she plays that really, really well. And I was very pleasantly surprised by Jennifer Saunders. I mean, she hasn't done anything on stage, apparently, for 20 years, and that's probably the only other play she ever did, as far as I understand it. And I thought she was very impressive, and they did another one of those songs in front of the curtain between acts. They only did it once this time. They did it three times, I think, in the earlier play. But it's clearly a very good idea, and it allowed Jennifer Saunders to sort of show off her undoubted comedic talents, but also allowed some of the people in smaller roles to sort of come forward and showcase those as well. So I did like that. And this time it wasn't a musical song as they were last time. It was actually a song that Kathy Burke wrote. So I think, you know, it's an enjoyable, pleasant enough evening, but I wasn't really sure the play is worthy of all this resources and talent, really. And it was an enjoyable evening, but I'm not sure if somebody said to me, do you think I should pay 50, whatever it is, pounds to go and see it, I'd probably say, not unless you're desperate to see some of the star casting, as it were. So enjoyable, but that's about it, really. You can live without it, I think is where it's summed up.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.